the best-kept secret in aviation. Has its time finally come? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guests today are Pat Murphy of Pro Aero Solutions and Paul Whetstone, who is the president of Interceptor Aircraft Corporation. We're here to talk about an announcement that was made in the last couple of days about the sale of the Myers Aircraft Company, which is an operation that falls within Interceptor Aircraft Corporation. We're here to talk specifically about the Myers 200 series and I-400 series aircraft, for which all the manufacturing, tooling, drawings, parts, and type certificates are for sale. And it's just a real interesting airplane to talk about because it's got an interesting history, and it still has some very interesting competitive assets to bring to the table in today's aviation environment. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me today.
Nice to be with you. Good to be speaking with you.
Paul, let me start by asking you about the background of the aircraft. It's fascinating to read about. This aircraft first went into production, it looks like, in 1953, and there are about 100 left flying in the U.S., or I guess in the world right now. This aircraft is a chrome moly frame, single-engine piston aircraft with aluminum skin, which still has some very, very competitive numbers if you stack it up against the best that general aviation has to offer today.
Exactly. It was designed many years, well, when I say many, about 6 or 7 years after the Beech Bonanza, basically as a Bonanza beater. And they always kept jumping Continental engines, leapfrogging from the IL-470 to the 520 to the 550. But the Myers held the official FAI speed record in class C-1B for 18 years. There's not a single production aircraft that could beat it. It took first, second, and third in the pylon races in Reno in 1967. So these are speed records. The airplane is just very, very fast, and it's very, very strong.
Well, now, obviously, anybody who buys a Bonanza, speed is at least one consideration in that purchase decision. Why has the Myers never broken through, do you think?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. Al Myers built them by hand. He had a small operation up in Tecumseh, Michigan. Literally, the tooling was up on ropes that pulled up to the rafters, and when somebody ordered an airplane, he built one. And it went through different iterations, the 200, the 200 A, B, C, and D models. But basically, when you wanted an airplane, Al would lower the tooling and build it with a small band of craftsmen. So all of the early Myers are all different.
All right, now this airplane eventually went on to become the Aero Commander 200. But they never really figured out how to build it.
Well, that's correct. When they built a production facility in Albany, Georgia, and they set out to purchase the type certificates to some existing aircraft. They didn't want to do any initial design down there, and they bought, you remember, airplanes like the Lark and the Darter,
mm-hmm.
and there was an AG plane, I believe it was a Thrush, and they bought the Myers 200. Well, when they sent six semis up to Tecumseh, Michigan from Albany to pick up the tooling, and everybody started laughing. You know, one guy come up and say, "Hi, my name's Ernie," and they pull a little notebook out of his back pocket and says, "I built the wing for 15 years. We don't need any tooling." and so hard production tooling for the aircraft did not exist.
Mm-hmm.
So Aero Commander had to start and build all of the production tooling that we have today, and instead of costing that out as a line item for the tooling, they reported back to their headquarters, I believe it was in Bethany at the time, that these were the man hours it was taking to build the aircraft. And I've got letters documenting this in the old files that I've got. And they were reporting that it was taking over 10,000 man hours to build the airplane, and that's just not true. They were rolling in the cost of building the production tooling to kind of cover up for the fact that they didn't do their due diligence and realize that there was no hard tooling in the first place.
Well, now, two things surprised me about this. First of all, is they got, by all accounts, 80 or 85 aircraft into this process before they came to this conclusion. First of all, I would think that they'd been able to spread some of that cost out over those airplanes and have a better looking number. But secondly, this was a division of North American Rockwell. I guess it's surprising to me that they didn't figure this out before they sent the semis.
Well, I understand that the individual that they sent down to Albany to build airplanes was a prospective son-in-law of Mr. Rockwell. And I'm told that they just wanted him out of Bethany. So you can read between the lines there. But, Al Myers himself built 43 airplanes. Then when Aero Commander started building airplanes, they ended up building 83. That's the total number that were built.
Okay.
They finally got their tooling standard, and they started with serial number 301. They finally got the tooling standardized and the aircraft standardized at about serial number 350.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to the next time it changed hands. Then when Rockwell's Aero Commander Division got rid of it, where did it go from there?
Well, there was an attorney in Detroit. His name was Lyman Lyon that had had dual degrees. He also had a mechanical engineering degree, and somehow he had flown behind turboprop power. He was in the Navy, and he had done research and figured that the Myers airframe was the strongest airframe in general aviation, the only one that you could simply bolt one of the new emerging turboprops onto. At this time, it would have been the Garrett, the TP-331-1. Mm-hmm. And he approached Aero Commander to just make him an airplane. And they said, no, our accounting has determined that we're spending too many man hours on the airplane. We're going to get rid of this and design our own aircraft in-house, which became the Rockwell 112, which was designed simply to take less man hours to produce.
Okay.
Then they approached Lyman Lyon and said, why don't you buy the whole company and do it for yourself? And that was the genesis of Interceptor Corporation. And they took all the assets from Albany, moved them to Norman, Oklahoma, hired Don Long, who was an ex-Rockwell engineer. He's the engineer that certified the 1123 jet commander. And they set out to certify a turboprop pressurized version of the Myers.
Okay. All right. And so that's where the newer design came from. How did you come to acquire the company?
Well, the company was not really well funded, as a lot of startup aircraft companies are. The engineers told them they could do this in 6 months and $600,000, and it ended up taking 3 years and $3.5 million. Typical problem. So they.
I have to just butt in here and interject that if you talk to somebody today about getting an aircraft through Part 23 for $3.5 million, they'd laugh at you.
I mean, I know. This was supposed to be a simple modification, just change the engine and pressurize it.
Right.
Which at the time they figured was simple, but and then they had a little bit of bad luck with the first production aircraft. It has a dual set of covers over the wing fuel tanks. And if you're just an absolute idiot, it's possible to not lock the inside cover and force the outside cover, which is an aerodynamic cover, down over it. At that time, the FAA would not allow you to certify a single-engine turboprop with a left-right fuel selector valve.
Hmm. Okay.
And so the pilot did this on a press demonstration flight in Santa Monica, California, and that created a suction in the left wing, and it sucked all the fuel out of the right wing, so the left wing kept getting heavier and heavier, and they ran out of aileron authority. They were circling out over the water. They were going to land it on the beach. It was on a Saturday morning. Bob Parrish was on board, who I believe at the time was the editor of Air Progress. But they ended up ditching it in the water off the coast. Of course, being pressurized, it floated, and mm-hmm. The surfers came out to see the dead bodies, and here's two guys in business suits just sitting there looking at each other without any injury whatsoever. And they pushed the airplane up on the shore, and the guy stepped out and only got their shoes wet. But the airplane was basically ruined. It rocked in the surf for about 6 hours before they could get a crane in. Meanwhile, so the insurance company picked up the airplane. Interceptor bid all the money they had in their account at the time, and the bid was beaten by the gentleman that owned American Jet Industries at the time, who later bought Gulfstream. What was that, Al Paulson?
Yeah, that was Al Paulson.
So Interceptor was without an aircraft. They got money to build a second airplane, which I have, took it across the country to get and got about 50 orders for the airplane on one press demo flight, but never could get production capital because every time that they would disclose F. Lee Bailey stepped in and sued the company.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the height of his popularity, and he alleged that it was a design error. And the FAA did a full investigation, said, no, it was pilot error. He didn't close the fuel tank properly.
Right.
And it took 8 years in the courts when a gentleman, Peter Luce, he had stepped in and was funding the company. He finally won that lawsuit, but it was 8 years in federal court, so they never could get production capital. By that time, all the assets were in mothballs, basically, in different areas around the Denver-Boulder area. And I just happened to run into an ad in Trade-A-Plane, I think it was, selling the Interceptor itself was for sale.
Right.
And I contacted Mr. Luce and told him that I thought I could do something with the company and raise the production capital because I felt that there was a need for the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The only pressurized, you know, single engine aircraft out there, and they were just going to sell the airplane off.
Well, guys, I want to take a break here, but when we come back, I want to talk first, Pat. I want to get you involved in the conversation a little bit and tell us about your background with the company and where it is today, and then, guys, I want you to both kind of tell me, you know, what this aircraft brings to the table in the 21st century. My guests are Paul Whetstone, who is the president of Interceptor Aircraft Corporation, and Pat Murphy of Pro Aero Solutions. And we'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9000 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips, composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, and I'm talking today with two guys who are familiar with a Myers Aircraft Company, which is for sale. And those guys are Paul Whetstone, who is the president of Interceptor Aircraft Corporation, and Pat Murphy of Pro Aero Solutions. Both of these guys are joining us today from Texas. Pat, let me talk to you for just a moment about your background with the company and how you came to be involved with its current situation.
Tell you the truth, I found out about Paul through a friend, a gentleman that is an old friend of Paul's and an old friend of mine, and just general conversation. And one day was talking to me about it, and next thing I know, I was on the phone with Paul, and we just kind of grew from there. We have come to an agreement, an exclusive marketing agreement, where I'll be negotiating any and all sales between Paul and the Interceptor Aircraft Corporation and just whoever. I'm currently dealing with several people. As I mentioned in my press release, it's a small world. The news really travels quite rapidly.
Oh, yeah.
And I tell you, I've been getting a lot of calls from overseas. I've got a lot of from Saudi Arabia, India, Israel. I've also had a couple meetings with some private investors here in the United States. I've already found out about it being available. And also, I won't mention a name right now. I don't think they'd want me to, but we do have a U.S. broker. I mean, a U.S. manufacturer mm-hmm. that's very interested in aircraft as well.
Well, and that brings me to my next question, and you guys can, either one of you can take this as you want to, but, you know, right now all the talk is about composite And, you know, and here's an aircraft which, if I'm not mistaken, stacks up pretty well against a lot of the newer stuff on the market. Even if it's powered with a 200 horsepower normally aspirated engine, it's going to be, you know, a 200 knot airplane. Where does this fit into the current competitive landscape, and who would buy this aircraft if it gets back into serial production?
The composite versus aluminum issue is still unresolved. I talk with Boeing engineers, and the quote that I get from them is the more they learn about composites, the better aluminum looks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a market for a real aluminum airplane, no matter what. It takes heat better. You don't have to store it inside. You don't have to have special paint. You don't have to have two-wire electrical systems. You don't have to put special lightning strike protection in them. There's a whole lot of advantages to aluminum airplanes that the composites still have yet to catch up on. Where money's no object in military applications and you want a stealth-type operation and you can use very expensive composites, that's a good application. But for general aviation aircraft, the ability to repair one in the field and to have it made out of a material that we know what happens with, at temperature extremes, we know what happens if it sits in the sun, I think there will always be a market for aluminum aircraft, you know, in that particular area. It's really more the design. Had they done the Starship, I've had Raytheon engineers tell me, had the Starship been made out of aluminum, it still would be in production today.
Well, and frankly, it would have faced far fewer regulatory hassles.
Exactly.
I don't think there's any question that there's a market for aluminum aircraft. But if someone's to buy this now and get it into serial production, I see a couple of advantages right off the bat. First of all, if they can buy it for a price that makes sense, and I won't even get into that conversation right now, but assuming they can buy it at the right price, a lot of the work is done. What would need to be done to this aircraft to bring it up to the point where it would look competitive sitting on a showroom floor in 2008?
It's actually very, very competitive. We've been dealing with the Department of Defense of several different countries, and they have specifically asked for a trainer with the 23,000 series NACA airfoil. This wing that we have was ahead of its time when Al Myers chose it. It's the same wing that's on the Citations. It's the same wing that's on the Piper Malibu, the King Airs. It's mm-hmm. a wing that you can fly in icing conditions. The wing is a good wing. You have incredible protection in the event of an off-airport landing. They're very, very fast. On a Continental IO 550 engine, the airplane will do 200 knots normally aspirated.
Mm-hmm.
So our challenge is just to build them and sell them at a price that's competitive in the market. I think the aircraft itself only needs to be upgraded in terms of avionics, things that would have been done had the aircraft been in production. It will certainly have a glass cockpit. It will certainly have all the latest and greatest RBSM, if we're talking the interceptor and things like that, and it's got more room in it than a Bonanza. I'm 6'6", and I can sit in it and wear a cowboy hat.
And I can picture you doing that. I can picture you doing that.
Exactly. And you can put two people my size in the back seat, mm-hmm. in the back two seats. So I mean, and the last time I looked, people were getting bigger in this country, not smaller.
Exactly. The so-called FAA standard person's become a 44 portly.
Right, exactly.
Well, guys, what are you looking to do here? I mean, who exactly are you looking for and what kind of arrangement? Paul, are you looking for something that will keep you involved in the company?
Not necessarily. If they want, I think they're going to have me for a period of years, a couple of years anyway, just to help transfer the technology, because I've been single-handedly keeping this thing off the market for the last 27 years,
mm-hmm.
On purpose. We made some small forays to see what the market was like, but they were just very bad timing. We spent a lot of money, updated the airplane, put a new panel in it, had it beautiful, took it to the NBAA in Dallas in 84
mm-hmm.
when Burt Rutan happened to fly the 7/8 scale model of the Starship overhead. And just everybody went gaga over composites.
Right.
And now finally the table's turned and you're finding, you know, composites are not the panacea that everybody thought. That yes, things can be done, but there are a lot of problems with them also, which is why, you know, even like the Eclipse, they chose aluminum, not composite,
mm-hmm.
For all the, some of the reasons that we talked about. So, And then, of course, we had the crash of the general aviation market, the Cessna quitting production of single engines altogether. The statute of repose had to be passed to get people out of some of this unbelievable liability problems that we were in. Then we had an oil crash, and then we had 9/11, and, you know, it just goes on and on in terms of just bad timing, things that we couldn't control.
Well, assuming the timing is better now, I guess the question would be where does someone go from here if they're interested in either the aircraft as a potential customer or the company as a potential customer? Pat, maybe you could talk to that.
About 3 minutes before our call today, I had a phone call from a defense firm in California, and we had a meeting 2 days ago in regards to prospective customers for this airplane, and he currently has 25 aircraft order for the Myers in the event that it does go back into production, with a willingness to put a very large multi-million dollar deposit down just to secure that aircraft order. And that's just in one country, and it's a foreign country. He's also talking to the Air Force in Australia, who is fixing to update their entire fleet and needs to do so by 2012. So, you know, there's so many options available, and there's so many directions to go in. It's going to be very interesting to see where this thing actually lands. Like I said, this is unadvertised. There's very little word about it going out, but it's just funny how it's everybody's starting to come, you know, to come out of the woodwork to talk about Myers Aircraft. Some folks know about the robust construction of the aircraft, which I believe is one big reason why they're contacting us, and it's exciting. Paul, it's really exciting. I'm anxious to see where this thing's going to go.
Well, it's always exciting to see a design that never really got its due finally have its day in the sun, and it looks like you guys may be on the verge of that.
Well, I was going to say about 50% of the existing Myers out there are owned by ex-military guys, even ex-FAA guys. There's an article about that on the website. Real pilots that know what an airplane should fly like. It has been flown by the U.S. military, by the way, back in the JPATS sort of fly-off, and I just couldn't meet their requirements. The RFP was bundled such that I would have had to make too many alliances with, you know, you had to provide the training syllabus, the parts, logistics support for 20 years, on and on, and I was just not in a position to do it. But it flies like an airplane should fly. That's what we hear when commercial pilots, a lot of them are owned by ex-airline pilots, pilots that really understand what an airplane should feel like and how it performs, and it just gets rave reviews. If you ever have a chance to fly in a Myers, you need to do it.
Well, the website is MyersAircraft.com, and Pat, your phone number, if someone wants to get a hold of you about getting serious about the company itself, is area code 210-859-0937, and we'll have that in print form, too, for anybody who accesses this on the Internet. Guys, I want to really thank you for bringing us some details on this this classic design, and it looks as though it's weathered well in terms of its relevance to today's market, and I wish you both the best in going forward.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul. Really appreciate it for having us on.
You can find out more about these timeless aircraft at MyersAircraft.com. That's M-E-Y-E-R-S, aircraft, all one word, .com. My guests have been Paul Whetstone, president of Interceptor Aircraft, and Pat Murphy of Pro Aero Solutions. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you can find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.